It's my great pleasure to welcome some two very special guests from all the way from Northern Ireland today, Marion O'Rourke and Fidelma Carolan. And they'll be talking about the worker registration and quality and safeguarding people with disability in Northern Ireland. So in Northern Ireland, social care workers have been regulated since 2016, which was phased in by a four-year rolling program starting in 2012. In that time, over 36,000 workers from a range of social care disciplines across residential, community, housing and advocacy services were registered. As a public protection measure, the process involved engagement from a range of stakeholders, including employers, people who use services and their families, government and trade unions. As a part of this, a code of fitness to practice was introduced and standards developed to improve quality of delivery and consistency. So I would like to welcome them to talk about how this all worked, considering this is the space that Australia is starting to delve into now. So thank you and welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can everybody hear us okay? Yes, okay. And apologies that we're going to sit, but in terms of the live feed stream, I think that's going to work best. But I appreciate that maybe people in the room can't necessarily see us so well, but do feel free to move around. And we are going to use some slides for our presentation. We will have a number of very short videos in it. Our apologies that our videos are not subtitled. We need to get better at planning in terms of the whole range of audiences that we've had to present to, and we'll talk about what we've been doing since we've come here, but apologies for the lack of subtitling on our videos. Okay, so I'm going to start with me, and then Fidelma can introduce herself in a minute. My name's Marion. I'm the Director of Regulation and Standards with the Northern Ireland Social Care Council, and we are the regulatory body for the social care and the social work workforces in Northern Ireland, and I'll tell you a little bit about that in a minute.
My name is Fidelma Carlin. I'm a former regional organiser with the trade union Unison, which is the largest trade union in the United Kingdom, with 1.4 million members, 40,000 of whom are in Northern Ireland, predominantly health, social care, non-teaching staff in education, and the community voluntary sector.
So we're going to start with, I suppose, just a little overview of Northern Ireland. How many people in the audience have been to Northern Ireland?
Oh, a few.
Oh, that's great. Did you all like it? Good.
You have to say that.
Good. And those of you who haven't been to Northern Ireland, hopefully after this presentation, you will be really keen to come and visit us. And sorry? Yeah, I hope so. And so come and visit
questions.
Us. Sorry.
What is the difference between Northern Ireland and the other island? There are two islands.
So Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom. So we have Scotland, England and Wales as one, three countries but joined up on one landmass. And then we have Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland just over to the left of them if you're looking at a map. So Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom, but we are on the island of Ireland. Okay, so we have a border with North and South. Okay. Sorry? Okay, so yes, unfortunately we are part of Brexit because we're part of the UK, and so yes, we are leaving, or we have officially left Europe.
We left Northern Ireland to come here, and the United Kingdom left Europe on the same day.
On the same day. So maybe we'll just stay here in Australia and not go back, because we don't know what that's going to look like. Yeah, absolutely. So
Northern Ireland, I suppose, just to give you a wee overview, we have a population of 1.8 million people, which isn't very big, particularly when you're talking to people from Australia. So we're very small, and as I said, we're part of the United Kingdom. But we're a good place, and some of these photographs are really just to entice you to come. This is a photograph of the Giant's Causeway on the Antrim coast, so it's a really, really nice place to come and visit. A couple of facts, I suppose, just about us. We have a very good education system. We're very proud of our education system, and most of our young people will go on to either further or higher education. However, we do have issues around a number of our school leavers leaving without formal qualifications. We have two universities, two campus-based universities in Northern Ireland, and we have, obviously, the Open University as well, so a good education system. In terms of who the Social Care Council is, we are the regulatory body for social work and social care, and that's about driving up standards and ensuring a good quality of care and support for people who use our services in terms of social work and social care. And everything we do, I suppose, is based on wanting to improve those standards. And so we take a values-based approach. Sorry, go on ahead. We take a values-based approach to our model of regulation, and I suppose the one value that we focus on respect, on dignity, on meeting the needs of the individual. But one of the things that I want to talk to you about is in relation to partnership, that we regulate within a model of partnership. So we'll talk a little bit about that later. Okay, so just to give you an overview of our model of regulation, all regulators who regulate a workforce work on the basis of they set standards. So we set standards for conduct and practice. We bring people onto a register, and then we set requirements as to how to remain on that register. So a big focus in remaining on the register and being part of the registered workforce is around professional development. So the third arm of our model of regulation is around how do we support people to meet those standards. And through workforce development, we have a whole range of relationships and ways in which we engage and work with our registrants, we work with people who use the services, we work with employers, we work with education providers, all to ensure that the quality of care and support that is delivered is of good standard. So we set standards for our social workers, social work students, our social care workers, and I'll describe to you what we mean by social care in a minute, as well as setting a code for our employers. So employers have to support their workforce in terms of meeting their standards. So what am I talking about? I'm talking about over almost 45,500 people on our register. The vast majority of those are people who work in social care services. Over 38,000. The rest are social workers and social work students. So what do I mean by social care worker? What we mean here are people who work in adult residential care, children's residential care, supported living, so housing schemes where there is on-site support, home care, where people go out into people's homes to provide support. Day programs. So when we talk about daycare, that's not in relation to childcare. That's in relation to daycare programs for mostly adults provided at various centres. So that's the breakdown of who we mean by social care. So when Melissa talked about completing our registration over that time frame, that's the groups of social care workers that we have brought onto our register.
Just to pick up there, when we were introducing, when the notion of registration came in, was introduced for social care workers as a trade union, we were really, really concerned. We had a significant number of members who worked particularly in home care. These were highly skilled individuals, but unqualified, because there was no qualifications needed to come into a job in home care, or indeed many of the care professions at all. Most of the profile of home care were probably women over 40 whose child caring responsibilities had changed and were coming back into the workforce into a job where no qualifications were needed, which suited them because generally they didn't have a lot of qualifications. So in Scotland, they introduced a qualifications-based register, so you must have had a minimum level 2 qualification to even come onto the register. In Northern Ireland, we would have lost 80% of our workforce overnight in home care. So we, as a trade union, and supported very much by the regulator, introduced a non-qualifications-based register. So you come onto the register by virtue of the job role you're doing. And we went out to our members, and there was a lot of engagement to provide assurance to them, because they were very suspicious. This was a government initiative. There was a feeling that someone was trying to catch them out, that this would be a way of them getting in trouble if they didn't do everything completely right. And also there were issues such as the cost of becoming a registrant as a low-paid workforce. And also the even things like literacy was an issue, and whether or not that will be a barrier for them to continue in a profession that they really, really loved. But we saw tremendous benefits as a trade union. One of the key things for us was about the professionalisation of the workforce, the recognition that this indeed is a workforce, not a loose collection of people working kind of independently. And it was always seen as very much, it's just a job, where we saw registration as an opportunity for a career, which would attract new people into the field. And one of the learning points has been is that home care, the profile of the home care workforce now has changed since then. You have a lot more young people coming in to work in support roles, in home care roles, in supported living. So that's for us, it's a really, really good thing. We also felt that because a part of someone's registration, they must do a minimum of 90 hours of learning over 5 years. Then while it was the individual's responsibility to find that learning, it was the employer had a responsibility to support their staff member to access that learning. And for us, that was tremendously important because our experience has been that the more qualifications you have, the more training you get offered. So if you're already a qualified nurse or social worker, you'll get offered loads of training from your employer. But if you are a care worker or support worker or a cleaner or a catering assistant, you're lucky if you get your mandatory training. So this really was a requirement for the employers to invest in people's learning and development, which supported the idea of this being a career and not just a job and progression. And also this was about public protection, because if I was talking to a group of 30 care workers in a room, inevitably at least half of them would have family members in receipt of care, perhaps aged care, and they wanted to be assured that the person looking after their loved one was equally kind of was on a register, and their practice could be stood over. And if their practice was poor and didn't meet the standards, that they could be removed from that register, and the people would be protected from poor practice. And a key thing for us as a trade union was the engagement with the regulator. And we work very, very well together because we have a common interest. As a trade union, we want to protect the rights of workers, but ultimately we want to ensure that they are providing a really high quality, valuable service to those that they're looking after or caring for or providing advocacy for. It's really important for us that worker is well trained, is well supported, and can do the right thing every time, and knows what they're doing, because they provide really high quality care, That's good for the person who's receiving the care. It's also good for the worker. So there's no contradiction for us in that, and that's really, really important. One of the things we developed was whistleblowing, because unfortunately some organisations were not very supportive and did not support their workers to provide good quality care. And we developed a guide whereby if somebody felt that their provision was being compromised or they saw poor practice, that they could call it out. Because it's very hard as a worker, a low-paid worker, to actually complain about your employer forcing you to provide poor quality care or seeing poor quality care, because you're afraid you'll lose your job in a rural area. Perhaps members of your family are working for the same company. So we provided guidelines to support people to be able to whistleblow properly.
So I suppose what we were trying to do is introduce a whole system approach to what social care should look like. This slide might be a little difficult to read from a distance, but what it really describes is a hierarchy of needs. So what are the key things that need to be around to ensure good quality care, a good experience for the people who use services, and I suppose a structure around what social care looks like. So in there you have a career structure, you have standards, you have supports for the development of the workforce, and you have a values-led workforce, a system whereby the people who are delivering the services are there because of a value base. So what difference are we making? We have taken a phased approach to the rollout of registration. Our initial rollout began way back in 2004 when we opened the register to our social work workforce initially, and then moved on through the various groups that I described throughout the social care workforce. And as Melissa said, we completed that in 2016-17. So what difference are we making? Our Department of Health have undertaken a survey in terms of impact on an annual basis since then. And so after year two, we were able to see that 73% of employers were telling us that the standards were making a difference to the quality of services that they were able to support and deliver. Two out of three of our social care workers were telling us that they had increased confidence in their ability to practice and deliver good quality services. And over 64% of staff were telling us that the standards helped to reduce and manage risk, that they felt that the people that they were working with were better protected as a result of the services. So we're going to play a very short video clip just to give you a sense of what some of our employers from the not-for-profit sector have been telling us about the difference that this scheme has made.
My name is Jane Wright. I'm the HR director for MindVice. We've been doing quite a bit of work with the Social Care Council. We've been very grateful for the work that they have done on values-based recruitment, and we've found it incredibly beneficial to us as an organisation. All of our staff have to be registered with the Social Care Council in order to work in this field. So it's really important for us that we help them to make the connection between the Social Care Council's values and behaviours and also our own. And the work that NISC have been doing has been really fantastic, helping employers map those behaviours and map those values of their own organisation across, so that the social care worker can make that connection between the Social Care Council's values and also the values of our own. I think it's incredibly important to demonstrate values and leadership in any organisation, and particularly an organisation like ourselves that's very values driven. We're a gold investors and people holder, and one of the key indicators of that is living the values. So that's the way we like to talk about it MindWise, is living our values. And we think it's incredibly important that those values are lived right from the boardroom right down, and that our leaders in our organisation role model those values so that staff can see what they're like. We've integrated the values very much into our strategy. We had service user involvement in deciding what these values actually mean and to show how important they actually are. They're the real cornerstones of all that we do. When we were communicating our business strategy, we also did values roadshows at the same time so that our staff really understood what the values were, we got their feedback on what these values look like for them, what does it look like in their day-to-day job, and what sort of behaviours would they manifest in displaying these values, because we just think it's so intricate and so important that everybody lives the values in mind-wise. I think there's huge benefits in using this approach because, first of all, we're setting out upfront who MindWise are and what we're all about, because for us, it's not just what we do, but how we go about doing things is really key and really important. We need to ensure that our service users, our clients, are central to absolutely everything that we do. And we can only do that whenever we live and breathe the values. But we believe that when our staff live the values, our staff themselves are much happier. It's better connectivity between our staff because they share common purposes and common values. But we believe that this then leads to better outcomes for our service users because our staff are our values, our passion, respect, empathy and togetherness. And they're all key and integral to absolutely everything that improves the journey for a service user. And we believe also creates a happier and a healthier workforce as well. We believe it starts at the very beginning. If you don't recruit people with the right values base, and then you'll not get people with the right values. So you have to set out very clearly what your value base is at the start. We've been doing some work recently in relation to values-based recruitment, which we have found incredibly useful to help us focus and think about how we translate that into recruitment. We've been on this journey in MindWise in developing our values-based recruitment, in ensuring that we get people that are the right fit for us, but also we're the right fit for them as an employer. Because it is a challenging job. It's a very rewarding job, but it is a very challenging job as well. So to ensure that people are coming to us with the right value base is the first really key important step. We then do actually incorporate that into our induction process. So the values roadshows that I talked about with our staff, we do those with all of our staff at induction as well. So we chat to them about what the values are, what they mean to them, how would they display them in day-to-day job, what's it mean like, what behaviours do they kind of develop and show.
Another aspect that I suppose we've learned from this scheme and this process is that there is a value to the economy from the social care sector that is often hidden and unseen and not really thought about in terms of government priorities. So one of the things we did was developed an economic review of the impact of social care in the economy. And I think that's a really important, I suppose, output that can result from a scheme such as yours that you're considering. I suppose, and I'm not going to dwell on this part of it for too long, but one of the things that any regulation scheme must include is a complaints process. For us, we call that fitness to practice, because that's about making decisions where someone's fitness to practice well is called into question. And we have a whole robust and transparent system that sits around that. But I should say that really only less than 1% of any workforce will eventually come before a fitness to practice process. So 99% of people out there are wanting and are doing a really good job. Very few are actually wanting deliberately or through their lack of knowledge and skills causing real harm and damage to people that they work with. So as I said earlier, I suppose our focus therefore is around helping and supporting the workforce to develop. And one of the things that we do through our regulation scheme, and I think is one of the added values or the value proposition of your scheme, is around how do you support learning and development? How do you encourage the workers on the register to develop their knowledge and skills? And we have worked quite closely with a range of partners to develop a whole range of online free resources and products. Some of them we've worked with Unison, with Fidelma, in terms of the kind of learning that supports the development of good practice. Do you want to say a wee bit?
So in Unison, We have Unison College where we offer members free a range of free workshops, everything from autism, stuff around learning disabilities, but also resilience, mental health awareness, palliative care, dementia, and it's available free to members. It's one of the benefits of being a member of our trade union. And from that point of view, that means that we get to engage with our members on a regular basis. It's a really, really important offering, you know, as a member of our trade union. It's something they can get. It's not just when they get in trouble that they may need a trade union. They get access to our learning. But also that it helps them be better at what they do. It helps them aspire to maybe progress into other areas. And because it's not necessarily job-related, it also helps people personally. So we could have a classroom assistant who will come and do a dementia course because one of their parents has been diagnosed with dementia. You could have someone who will do our suicide awareness course because they are a volunteer in their local church youth group. Whereas in a work environment, they can really only access learning that's directly related to the job that they're doing now, not perhaps the job that they aspire to, or maybe to access more general support like resilience or mindfulness training, which might help them in a more general way.
So again, we're just going to play a very short video clip from one of our social care managers who talks a little bit about the value of learning.
My job role is to ensure that the organisation staff are well equipped to meet their job roles and specifications and that they're able to have the right qualifications to do those things and that they're developmentally focused so that they can see what's going on around them, recognise changing needs, and then we work together then to see how we can meet those needs in skill and knowledge. If I look at other people that are in health and social care from the staff that we employ, then there will be people who are qualified as social workers, which everybody usually thinks about. But that's not the only route. Lots of health and social care organisations have level entry posts, so no qualification and no experience required. They will engage people who've got really strong values about humanity. And from that, they will help them to build their skills and their knowledge around social care. We employ people who've come from working in industry, ex-police officers, ex-store retail workers, people who've never had a career before at all and have raised a family, and then later in life when the family have grown have decided they'd like to do something. So they've come to us from having had nothing career-wise at all and can go on to be a frontline worker all the way through to being a manager over a range of services. It's a very open arena for work. Well, when you're working with human beings, every day is different. Nothing stays the same. You can predict some things, but you can never fully predict a human being. The skills and the knowledge that you have today may not be what you need tomorrow when you're working even with the same person. Keeping on top of what's happening in people's lives, what matters for them, how you can best support those people, work with those people, provide care to those people, means that you have to tune into their needs, you have to tune into the environment and how they respond to it and how it impacts on them. Knowing and understanding all those issues requires you to be keen to learn, to understand and to put things into practice. It doesn't necessarily mean qualifications, but it means knowing who you're working with and what's right for them and how you can fit that. If you don't have a real deep interest in people and their well-being and their value in life, it's not the job for you. If you have that and you intrinsically want to help people to have the best life they can have, then social care is a really good arena to do that in. Without social care, we couldn't exist as a society. We need social care workers. People will always need help and support and positivity around them, and that's what social care workers bring.
So what's our future direction, I suppose, a number of years into the scheme? For us, registration has provided us with a number of opportunities. One, I suppose, is about how to influence up into the system. In Northern Ireland, we are going through a whole range of transformation pieces of work around our health and social care system. And what we're recognising is
the pivotal role that social care has in transforming health services, and a real recognition about the impact that social care can make on people's lives. So there is very much a better focus, a better policy focus around where social care can fit into the whole system. The other developments that we are currently focusing on is around our use of technology, both in terms of assistive technology and how technology supports people to live their lives better, but also in terms of our use of technology in engaging with our workforce and providing them with learning opportunities. And also a recognition that we are now in a better position to develop a qualifications framework. We want to move towards a qualifications-based register. We feel that we have the opportunity to begin to do that in terms of how a career in social work might, or in social care might look like. And finally, I suppose we have a great opportunity, and you do too, through your registration scheme, to get involved in the whole leadership agenda in making sure that the profile of social care gets right up to leadership levels, and we do that through a partnership approach. So we've talked for long enough. I think we have one last video that we're going to leave you with, which captures a lot of the messages that we've tried to talk about. And after that, we are really interested to hear from you, to hear your experience, and you know, to have some discussion with you. No, back one. That's it.
No family at any time can say that they'll never need care. You've got to be able to enjoy your life, no matter what stage of life you're in.
You've got your own freedom and independence. I feel very capable in my daily life. If I didn't have social care, I wouldn't get the support that I need. Probably would struggle a wee bit.
I was 19 as I started as a care assistant. I left school with no qualifications. When I come in here and seen the opportunity, the training and the development, you know, it opened doors for me.
I think it is so important that we look after our people. It is so important that we value the people who look after our people.
People rely on us to care for their families, you know. They rely on us to look after people. They build up the trust with us. It is really important for them to have that place where they can say that their family member's safe and they're comfortable with them in there. They see their relationships building.
There's a social inclusion element and a social cohesion element to this sector because it's spread right across Northern Ireland. There are a few other sectors that could really lay claim to that other than retail and education, but this sector right across Northern Ireland is making an impact.
It brings me joy to know that I have impact, positive impact, you know, on a person's life. The residents don't live in our workplace, we work in their home.
It is a vitally important sector to Northern Ireland, employing directly just over 40,000 people. And in context, you know, that's bigger than the ICT sector and more than the financial services sector. That generates wages in excess of 500 million per annum. An enabling sector, as we've termed this sector, really supports the functioning of a lot more of the economy. So many things happen as a result of adult social care functioning well.
It has improved my quality of life, helped me to gain independent skills. You're good to the staff and the staff are good back to you.
My wife and myself, we have a very severely autistic child, and we've been fortunate to put in place a care plan at home that he can stay with. He's 22 now, and I can tell you those carers that come to the house greatly then enable whatever role I play in the economy. If I didn't feel comfortable that my son was being well looked after, I'm not sure I could play the role I currently play in the economy or indeed in my business.
I love coming in every morning, knowing that I'm here to help somebody that can't, you know, making them feel better as a person, building bonds and relationships with people. It's a great feeling.
This sector for us my attitude towards it changed. It felt like a bit of an invisible sector almost, you know, not one that gets a lot of light shone on it. So my attitude coming into it was no real sense of its importance. Going through the process, an element of enlightenment from my part. It's a very important sector to the Northern Ireland economy.
It is a very rewarding career for me. I didn't think I could do it, but I've came in through the doors, and yes, I can do it, and I do make a difference.
Our analysis would suggest this sector is vitally important to the Northern Ireland economy. The demands on it are increasing, and it needs to be moved up the priority list for government.
What type of society is it that wouldn't care for the most vulnerable in society? If we care for the most vulnerable in society, it will enhance the quality of life, and thereafter create the framework and the environment to ensure we maximise wealth creation.
Social care matters.
It's everybody's business.
It's my business.
It's your business.
It's his business. It's her business.
It matters to him. It matters to her.
It matters to me, and it should matter to you.
Social care matters. It's everyone's business.
So that just gives you a flavour and an overview of some of the messages that have come out of our experience in the registration scheme in Northern Ireland. So we're happy to hear from you now.
Carries from the last talk.
Okay.
Do you have an LGBT policy in your...
Yeah, so...
I thought so.
There is... Within the trade union, we actually have a very strong LGBT plus group. Within the Social Care Council, as a public body, it's obliged by under Section 75, which includes sexual orientation and gender identity in terms of any policies that come out of a public body in Northern Ireland, must make sure that it does not have an adverse impact on people on certain grounds, which includes LGBT plus and gender identity. So, yes.
Thank you. This is one question and one point. Does the Care Quality Commission operate in Northern Ireland?
No.
No.
It's England only.
Okay. The other point is, one of the major problems here in, as far as we're concerned, in residential care is minder care. Do you have that problem?
Can you explain what you mean by that? I'm not familiar with that phrase.
Well, we talk in residential care. Now, your term residential care may not be similar to ours, but we're talking, okay, we're talking group homes.
Yes.
As residential care.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Where they mind the residents rather than improving their quality of life and their skills and all this sort of thing. They're just minding them.
We have two types of, with three types of care. One is residential care. Secondly, nursing care, where you would have a nurse. So there would be some sort of medical needs that would need to be supported. And then independent living. In residential care, they would have, a lot of residential homes would have things like activities coordinators, but not all homes would have the likes of activities coordinators. The standards that are set by the service user regulator would include ensuring that the residents are still engaged with their communities of interest. So, for example, that could be a religious faith-based community. We would argue from an LGBT plus perspective that they should be encouraged to access the likes of Pride and supported to do that. It does depend very much on the individual home and their ethos, how much, I suppose, emphasis they have on the development of the residents rather than, as you say, just minding them and meeting their basic health needs.
So I suppose in terms of some of our care homes, it is very much about trying to meet the individualized needs of the person living there. So they will decide what level of engagement they will want, particularly around supported living, where people maybe with a physical disability live in independent accommodation. Maybe they have their own apartment, but they have on-site support. And people in those situations will decide how much level of engagement I will choose to or need to have in terms of the support that's available on there on the site. But the staff who are there are registered, are trained, are supported to be able to either provide the level of support that the person seeks or knows how to provide access to that level of support. And just going back to your question around QCQ, so or CQC, we don't have, but we do have, as Fidelma says, a service regulator in Northern Ireland, the RQIA, and it is their job to inspect services and employers' provision of services. So yes, we do. We have a regulator that sits across that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Pleasure.
I just had a quick question. Does this include youth workers?
In terms of the registration scheme?
Yes.
No, youth workers are not one of the designated groups that are identified through our legislation. However, there is grey areas because we took a phased approach to the introduction of the compulsion around registration. We did open the register to people and employers who felt that the services that they were delivering fell into social care. So a lot of youth and community workers, people working within maybe homelessness or addictions, felt that they did sit in there. So they can be on our register on a voluntary basis and supported by their employer. But one of the things that we think will be interesting and necessary for us to look at is, do we need to revisit the legislation and take this further? But we're not really ready to do that at this point in time in terms of a legislative approach. And so we do work with employers to see whether registration fits as broadly as possible with the needs. So yeah, they can get on to the register, but are not one of the compulsory groups.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you very much for that presentation. It was really, really valuable. I'm from Carers Victoria and I'm trying to put together our submission related to the Victorian Disability Worker Regulation Scheme.
Uh-huh.
So I've just got a couple of questions about how the Northern Irish scheme came about. First of all, what level of employer input was there in the actual standards?
Okay. So, as part of the development of our standards, we had a really wide-ranging engagement programme. So employers were very much part of that process. And the way we would have done that would have been through a series of workshops. So we would have talked broadly about what standards needed to look like, and then we would have begun some drafting and testing and you know what that looks like. So employers were a key part of that, particularly given that we had such a wide range of employers in Northern Ireland because we were working right across the whole sector, not just one part of the sector. So we had employers from disability, from mental health, from
Older people,
whole range. And we have employers who provide services both in terms of the statutory for-profit and not-for-profit sectors. So again, we had to engage with those. But equally important, in fact, more important to the employers was the people who used the services. So we had a significant programme of engagement with them as well. And we have, within our structures, I mentioned partnership early, and partnership is really key to how we work. So we have a participation partnership, which is a partnership of people who use services and their carers and their family members who come together to help us through all aspects of our work. Also on our council, the board of our council, one third of the council is made up of service user and carer representatives, as well as one third come from stakeholders, so that can be employers, and then another third is registrants. So we try to make sure that we engage and listen as much as possible. We don't always get it right, but we do work hard at it.
And the standards are freely available from the website, so that might be a good starting point even for consideration.
I will look into that. I've got two more questions, if I may. Just how casual or casualised is the workforce? And did you see a difference between when registration started and then now?
Yeah, it's more casualised than than a trade union would like. It varies. We have statutory provision, and then obviously that's contracted hours. We have been working with employers to provide contracted hours for staff, and a key element of that has been about security, and also being able to, because people on casual hours can't plan, they can't budget, and that seemed all very well and good till retailers and big business realised that people weren't spending money because they couldn't plan and they couldn't budget, and the casualisation of the workforce more generally was impacting on the economy. So interesting, we had a very strange alliance with big business around reducing the casualisation of workforce. Mm. I think it's always a challenge because these are commission services. So once it goes into the profit, not-for-profit sectors, then they're all competing against each other to provide a service and tend to undercut each other. And what happens then is they really struggle to provide the service because they've undercut to the lowest common denominator, which is not good for the organisation in terms of reputation, certainly not the worker, and definitely not the person who's receiving the service. Yeah. I think regulation has supported the professionalisation, and therefore organisations having to look at their workers rather than as casual jobs, even if the hours are casual, that actually they need continuity. It's very expensive for an organisation when there's churn. Mm. You bring people in and they leave, you invest in them for a short period of time, you put them through induction and they leave. So as we've been trying to encourage employers to, one, recruit people with the right values, look at what you're going to pay people, because if someone is paying 10p an hour more over the road, they're going to move. So you need to look at the added value of working for your organisation, because as much as people may love the work and are really committed to the people, they have to earn a living. Mm. So I think there's probably a combination of, in some ways, the commission services and moving out to not-for-profit and not-for-profit sectors has increased casualisation to some degree. But in some ways, the jobs are seen as in a more professional capacity. So we're hoping in the longer term that there'll be more continuity and more stability.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Because I'm not sure you know, but the workforce here is very casualised, but not the social care workforce in the aged sector for some reason. It's totally different. And then, sorry, one more question, please.
That's good.
You mentioned that your complaint system is transparent.
Yes.
What do you put in place to support that?
To ensure that. Okay. So, I suppose a number of things that we do, and all workforce regulators will do this. So the process is available at the point of registration and available as information to all, on our website. So it's available to anyone who wishes to see it. We also set very clear threshold standards and standards, what we call standards of acceptance. And we've worked with the unions as well and with our through our registrants forum. So we have, as well as a participation forum, we have a registrants forum. And on the registrants forum sit our trade union colleagues, and we worked with them to develop guidance around what a fitness to practice process would look like, what the threshold is, and to help employers understand what that is. Because there's a lot of, I suppose, behaviours or incidents that really fall within the remit of the disciplinary policies with employers and don't need to come to the regulator. And we don't want to clog up the system, clog up, you know, our system with stuff that employers need to deal with. So we publish very clearly what our thresholds are around. First of all, we have the burden of proof is beyond reasonable doubt. We have an investigation process. So we are particularly interested in the people who, and I suppose if you think about fitness to practice, the people who are potentially not fit to be in practice. So safeguarding issues, issues of real concern, the kind of things that we tend to see coming forward are around dishonesty, values and relationship-based stuff around abuse or neglect of their duties, false record-keeping, deliberate harm, those kind of things. The transparency then progresses on in terms of we publish all of our, through a notification system, we publish all of the details of our fitness to practice cases, so that's freely available on our website so people can see why a person has been removed from the register.
Independent panel.
And also Fidel was reminding me that our committees who undertake the adjudication process are all independently appointed, their committees of independent appointments.
And everybody has a right to representation. So if someone's a member of trade union, I can go and represent them as part of that process.
Yeah. And a right to appeal.
Yeah. I think one of the challenges for Victoria is that you're introducing a voluntary register. So we've heard the terms of a register of exclusion. Because we have a compulsory register, you can only work if you're on the register. If you're removed from the register, you can no longer work in social care. This is going to be the real challenge for you because it falls very short as a public protection measure. But there's also a real opportunity as part of the voluntary registration scheme to link it, you know, very closely to learning and development and really hang, because as in our experience, 99% of the register, that's over, I'm not even going to try and do the maths, but over 36,000 people anyway, are doing a really good job every day. So why would we put all of the investment into the 1%. You know, it's really important that regulation is linked to learning and development. And I think, again, because of the casualisation of workforce, because of self-management, I think that can be also a real challenge for workers to be able to access learning and development. And our conversations we've had here with government, with FISI, with our MIT, you know, we're looking at things, you know, things like microcredits, things like VCOS, organisations that are umbrella organisations or peak bodies, as you call them, working together and sharing resources to provide training and learning opportunities for each other's staff. You know, there's lots of things that organisations could do really, really cleverly and at very, very little cost to try and support people to access learning and development opportunities, which ultimately will allow them to be better at what they do and support people more effectively. I mean, there's no losers here in this process, as far as we can see.
Any last questions?
That's great. There were no hard questions. That's great. we were afraid we were going to get really hard questions. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for having us today. It's been a real privilege for us to be here with you. Thank you for those questions. We certainly wish you luck in your journey towards registration of the disability workforce. We think it is a great opportunity, and I am sure that you know, this forum will debate a lot of the questions that come out of that and the journey around that. And thank you to the staff here for looking after us and hosting us. So okay. Thank you very much.
Bye now.
Thank you very much, and it really is a privilege to have you both here today.